strong.
We have a quorum. I'd like to call the meeting of the Higher Education Finance Committee to order. And first order of business will be the minutes from our March 30th meeting. Representative Erdahl, would you look over the minutes quickly? And
I've read them in detail.
You've already done that.
Chairman, very good.
Very good. You move then that the minutes be approved?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl moves the minutes of March the 30th. Any discussion? Hearing none, minutes are approved.
Now we got a little football.
Our first bill up today is House File 263. And Representative Abrams, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 263 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Taxes. And Mr. Chairman, I would move the A1 amendment to put the bill into the shape I wish to discuss it.
Members should have that in their packet. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of amendment A1, say aye.
Aye.
Oh, and you're opposed? I know this committee well.
We're all in agreement today, Mr. Chairman.
We're very agreeable. Okay, now you have the bill in the way, in the shape that you like it. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here today as the chief author of House File 263, which will bring collegiate football back to the campus of the University of Minnesota. The bill is really quite simple. We have taken out a number of provisions that may have required it to make some other stops, but let me go through it very quickly. Section 1 makes the legislative findings relating to a football stadium, states that the purpose of the bill is to provide 40% of the funding for a new university football stadium. Section 3 recognizes the powers that the Board of Regents has, all the necessary powers to design, construct, equip, and operate a new stadium. Section 5, which is really the guts of the bill, provides the conditions for the payment of state dollars to the University of Minnesota. And it's really quite simple. Stadium will cost no more than $235 million. The university must raise $141 million from non-state sources in order to trigger the state payment. And the state payment is simply a $7 million annual payment per year. The amount of bonds issued pursuant to that $7 million is capped at $94 million. Section 6 is that these are revenue bonds and that they do not have the full faith and credit of the state. Section 7, which requires the bill to go to taxes, provides an exemption for the sales tax for stadium construction materials. A way to view that is that if the cost of the stadium is $235 million, approximately $120 million would be taxable. So it's about a $10 million cost to the state by having the sales tax exemption. I can probably say, with my experience in the tax committee, there probably isn't a better but-for test that there would not be a stadium constructed but for a provision such as this. Section 9 provides for the termination of the lease at the Metrodome, and the Section 10 is the effective date. As a way of brief introduction, this is not meant to be a complete solution to the stadium issues that are facing the state. However, one important element that is facing the state, if a Twin Stadium and Viking Stadium get approved down the road, is what do you do with the Gophers who move from Memorial Stadium on campus to the Metrodome in 1982? It will cost a minimum of $7 million a year to keep the Metrodome operating and as Coach Mason and some others will testify, the Metrodome doesn't fulfill the needs of the Gophers. So this is a first step to solving some of the issues that are outstanding. The university is confident it will be able to raise the $141 million. It is an important amenity for the University of Minnesota. I think that there are only two other Division I teams that share their stadium with a professional team currently. One is Pitt in the new stadium in Pittsburgh, and the other, as the new NFL stadium is being constructed in the Phoenix area, I believe that Arizona State University, the Sun Devils, are sharing their stadium with the Arizona Cardinals, but I believe that that's another year or two at the max. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to introduce Dick Fitzenreiter from the University of Minnesota and Glenn Mason, who not only is the coach of the Minnesota Golden Gopher football team, but also has had the grace and common sense to reside in House District 43B, excuse me. I should get that right, but 43B, and is a good friend and neighbor to all of us in Minnetonka. So I'll let the university folks make the presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Who's going to begin?
Coach Mason. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I've got the, I guess, the dubious honor of leading off. I live in 43B, is that right? I didn't know that until you learn something new every day, I guess.
Who is your representative?
I know who that is. He'd be sitting to my left. but thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address you today. I'd like to speak from two different positions. In my professional career as being a major college football coach at the University of Minnesota, and number two, of being a resident and taxpayer in Minnesota, very interested in the University of Minnesota, very interested in the students at the University of Minnesota.
Can I interrupt for just a minute? For technical reasons, we need you to formally identify yourself for the record for anyone that wants to listen to this at a future date.
Okay, great.
I guess we need to formally do that. So
I apologize.
Sorry.
Do I need to start over then again or not? Good, because I can't remember what I said. My name is Glenn Mason, head football coach at the University of Minnesota. As I was saying, very interested in the University of Minnesota students and really the total experience that one should enjoy during their college career and the association with the university as a lifelong experience. As a football coach, I look at what we're trying to do as far as bringing Gopher football back to campus as a necessity, an absolute necessity, not as a luxury. Simply stated, we have no home field advantage to put on, not the game, but the college event, with all the atmosphere that goes with the collegiate game as we know it today. We have had well-documented problems in just scheduling our Big Ten schedule over the last couple of years, where we had to move dates, even contemplating move home games to away games, play on a Thursday night, play on a Friday, move our games from afternoon to morning, sometimes morning to night. Just an endless problem that is getting worse. The Big Ten schedule just recently came out, and over the next 3 years, we'll only play two home football games in the month of October. That is a big, big competitive disadvantage. Quite frankly, we can't even argue about it because of the problems that we've gone through scheduling our home slate because of the conflicts with Major League Baseball. Quite honestly, we've been put in a potentially embarrassing situation by the position of a lot of the Big Ten members. And we are a charter member of the Big Ten Conference, and you really can't be a competitive, athletic competitive member of the Big Ten Conference unless you play football. A position when Penn State and Ohio State and Michigan and Michigan State and Wisconsin and Iowa, almost every Big Ten school has maybe not built a new stadium, but have literally put hundreds and thousands of dollars in their facilities to keep them up with modern times. And they've become very irritated with us, even from the standpoint of suggesting in closed meetings of the Big Ten that, you know, hey, maybe we ought to get with it or get out, because we're not tending to the business of playing major college football the way we should. Recruiting, which is the lifeblood of any program, and I don't feel like I'm a Johnny come lately as far as the University of Minnesota. I'm starting my ninth year, and I've had a problem recruiting each and every year. If you can imagine, when I go to recruit the best players that the state of Minnesota has, and then really the other players from across the country, you know, bring them on our recruiting weekends, and we don't have them a football field that we can show them where we play. Yeah, we've got the dome. Last year we had 7 weekends that we were allowed by NCAA rules to recruit. Not one of those weekends could we have that facility set up as a football facility, a collegiate football facility, to show these prospective student athletes where they're going to play. Why? Because there's a tractor pull one weekend and there's a snowmobile racing event another weekend, so on and so forth. It's really made our job awful tough. We don't even have what we would call our own locker room at the Metrodome that we control. It's used as a visiting team locker room for the NFL, for Major League Baseball, at times. If not, the Twins players' families use it as a child care center during their season. So it's made my job a little bit more difficult, even though most people, I would like to emphasize, think we've done a pretty good job. At the same time, they say, Coach, when are we going to get back to the Rose Bowl? And we're trying to get there as fast as we possibly can, but we need some help. We need some help, and I think a big piece of that, if not a major piece, is conducting our business at the Big Ten level the way it should be conducted. Another area, and I would feel this way even if I wasn't the head football coach at our great institution. I spent my entire adult life on a college campus, whether it was a college student and a player and then as a coach. And I love the collegiate life. I love everything that goes with it. And I think that, yeah, that academics are first and foremost the responsibility of our great institutions, but there's also a social component to that. I find very few people that went to college, when they refer back to their college days, that they went to good old college days. And they're not talking about studying English and history and all those things. And one of the things at our level that I think is very visible is the event in the fall in major college football. Since I've come back to the University of Minnesota, which I love dearly, to me there's been one thing missing, and that's that event on our college campuses that our students typically would get involved in. They'll bring the fans back to the campus for a weekend, number of times a year. Keep alumni coming back year after year after year. I remember as a former player in the Big Ten and as a former coach at a couple of Big Ten institutions, while Memorial Stadium was still intact, of coming here. And it was really a glorious sight. You'd come in as an opposing team, you'd come down University Boulevard, and those fraternity and sorority houses were alive and well, and everybody had some type of function on their lawn. And now you look at those fraternities and sororities, and you know what? They're in disrepair. They really are. I jog by them all the time. You know why? Because the people with money have no reason to come back there anymore. They don't come back to the campus, I think, like they should. So with that, I really appreciate the time to be able to address you. And, you know, I don't know if this is appropriate or not. I remember when we first started talking about this many, many years ago, there was a meeting on the campus, a faculty committee, and there was a faculty member that happened to oppose the stadium. He said to me, Coach, I want you to know one thing. He says, I want to speak for many of my friends in the faculty who are opposed to a football stadium. And I said, well, I can appreciate that. I said, I want to tell you, I don't think anybody gets around the campus like I do to talk to students. And the students on our campus, they want a stadium. And he said, well, what is that supposed to mean? And I said, I don't know, but I learned a long time ago you can't have a circus without the animals. And I'm not saying that our students are animals, but that's why we're there. And I think we're there to really provide a comprehensive approach to Big Ten collegiate life. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. We have a question from Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Coach Mason, before I get into my question, I don't know if you realize, but we do have a former University of Minnesota football player here today, and Representative Eastland, I think, still has maybe a year or two of eligibility left. Talk to him later.
See any good?
That's all he's.
With all due respect.
Coach Mason, a couple of, I guess, a question, a comment. In the early 1980s, a dome stadium was, deemed essential for recruiting. And this doesn't have a dome on it. You feel that that's not essential to get players from Florida, Louisiana, and the South up here?
Coach Mason.
I would be opposed to a dome stadium. And I only say that I really don't think that our weather is any different through the month of November than it is in places like Iowa City or Ann Arbor or East Lansing or Lincoln, Nebraska. It might be in December and January, but we don't play home football games in December and January. Since I haven't been here my entire life, obviously, but I've not witnessed any home weather that you typically would have to play in that you wouldn't play in those other venues I already talked about. And during recruiting, yeah, it's cold when we recruit up here, but it's cold in Columbus, Ohio, and the other Big Ten cities too. And it's I think that we've been one of the first things that I was impressed with when I came to Minnesota was that Minnesotans, they didn't endure the winter, they celebrated it, the weather I should say. And I think I think we've been sold an idea, which, and I'm trying to be critical of the people back in the 80s, that you had to show them an indoor facility because there was going to be snow on the ground. I think a lot of people sell their programs when there's snow on the ground.
Representative Berdahl.
Thank you, Coach Chernornis. I just like to make a brief comment by saying that I commend the University of Minnesota for bringing forth a proposal that I think is reasonable. It'd be, I think, interesting if the Twins and Vikings were able to put something together along a similar nature. And I tend to be supportive of anything that's going to help us beat Iowa, Wisconsin, and whatever we did with Michigan the last 2 years.
Amen.
All right, any other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. There may be questions later, but right now, we move the microphone over to the end of the table, and we'll have Richard Fitzenreiter, is it?
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Richard Fitzenreiter, and for those listening 100 years from now, I go by Fitz. I'm going to take you quickly through the handout that was placed before each of you, and I'll jump around. I think the coach here described very well why this is important to do now. I want to emphasize and turn really to page 4, start on page 4 of the document, to talk about what the project is and how we propose to finance it. You can think about this project in three pieces. There is a site that needs, to some degree, environmental cleanup. We need to purchase a small piece of land to widen a road, and we need to demolish some buildings that are currently just about vacant. The last little unit in it is Landcare. To do this, we got to clean up the site, we got to buy a small amount of land, we got to demolish some buildings. There's a cost of that I'll talk about in a second. Then the second piece of it is the district, getting everything back up to the walls of the stadium, moving roads, landscaping two large plazas, putting in the new signaling, putting the parking back down on the site. It's currently a parking lot, putting all that back, doing the intersections, the new roads, etc. There's a cost to that. And then the third piece is the walls and the field of the stadium, constructing that. The stadium itself is a 50,000-seat horseshoe-shaped stadium. It's expandable to 80,000 at a later date, but again, this is just 50,000 with an open-end horseshoe-shaped bowl. There'll be 39 suites, roughly 300 indoor club seats. That's also then attached to about 1,250 outdoor club seats. There is, as I mentioned, an indoor football indoor club. And also we're planning in this a relatively new concept called luge seating, which for those that go to the racetrack, for the ponies, the horses, you'll see little areas sort of roped off where there might be a table and four chairs. And even though it's outdoors, we may add a little space heater. But a new concept of putting in luge seats. There will be a Hall of Fame and a home for the marching band. Currently, the marching band at the University of Minnesota is cramped into the basement in Northrop Auditorium. This will give them new quarters, a new practice facility, and, of course, the field to actually practice on. It will be designed to be suitable for recreational sports activities and soccer. In other words, the stadium sight lines will be such that it will be conducive to soccer activities whenever it's needed to be used. Naturally, it will have a home and visitor locker rooms. And for the most part, this stadium will be nice but austere. We are not planning high-end finishes. That adds a lot to the cost. When we've gone around the country and looked at pro stadiums, for example, some of the high-end finishes add a lot to the cost. This is going to be a very austere facility. And for example, on the picture over here where you see the one side of the building with an actual facility, the rest of the side, the north, the east, and the south side of the stadium, other than the part that faces Mariucci and Williams, that will be the only building, enclosed, you know, heated building that's constructed. The rest of the stadium, in order to save on the operating costs, will be open concourse in which in the wintertime we can shut it down, turn off the water, not have to heat it. So we're thinking about trying to conserve the costs and just have a certain part of the building usable year-round. If you turn to the next slide, 5, you can see the site. It is currently a large parking lot with roughly 2,100 parking spaces on it. We will need to realign, for example, Oak Street currently spills right through in front of Williams and Mariucci Arena, and we have a desire to move that back towards the stadium and create a nice large mall in which we would close down the street on game day for all those game day activities, pregame activities. We will be able to put all of the parking, this is a very important student parking area, and we will be able to put all the parking back down on that site or right next to it. You turn to the next page, why now? Why is it important that this stadium bill pass now? Our desire is to open in the fall of 2008. For us to be able to do that, we need to start this project today. We have already been designated the responsible governmental unit for purposes of an environmental impact statement, a study that's required by state law, and we're proceeding with that effort. That needs to get done for us to move into the design phase of the project and move then into construction. So we need this spring, this summer, to begin taking down buildings and doing work to get this project on schedule to open in the fall of 2008 or lose to inflation on the cost of the building. If you turn to page 7, as I mentioned, there's three components: the site, cleanup, demolition, put back roads, realign. Site is 17, district is roughly 27 million, and the stadium construction itself is 191.4 million. That's the $235 million total cost for the stadium. Our proposal that's reflected in the bill before you is for the state to pay 40% of that cost while the university pays 60%. The 40% cost would be covered with an annual appropriation of $7 million a year that reflects the principal and interest payments for 25 years on that $94 million of debt that would be issued by the University of Minnesota. We're not asking the state to issue that debt. The university will issue the debt. We're simply looking for that $7 million a year to pay the principal and interest. If you turn to the next page, I'm going to talk for a minute about the university's strategy on its 60%. The $141 million, we're looking primarily in three broad buckets. Student support. Some of you may have heard that the students, now I'll admit not all the students, but the undergraduate students so far, and we are in discussions with the graduate and professional students, have supported a $50 per semester fee in support of a stadium. That $50 per semester fee, if it's applied to all undergraduate, graduate, and professional students on the Twin Cities campus only, will generate enough annual revenue to support $50 million of construction for the stadium. We also will have something we don't have today because we don't have the stadium on campus, game day parking revenues that I can also, the university will also leverage into debt service for construction of the stadium, the issuance of debt, of about $16 million. And then the last piece is $75 million in sponsorship and fundraising. And what we mean by that is stadium naming opportunities. And you're no doubt familiar with our recent announcement of the name of a stadium after TCF Bank Stadium, a $35 million naming rights agreement that we've entered into with them. And we're also looking at other naming opportunities, what we call sponsorships, inside the stadium for things like a professional archway or the West Plaza or South Plaza. I had always had hopes to get Sid Hartman to name the press box, but I don't think it's going to happen. But we're looking at opportunities, talking with Minnesota corporations about naming opportunities. We do not intend to name every nook and cranny or every part of the stadium after a corporate entity. We're probably looking at somewhere between 6 and 8 major naming opportunities as part of raising that $75 million. The other part that we're working diligently on is private fundraising or philanthropic gifts for the stadium. We have had some success in that already, and we'll hope very soon to be announcing some additional major gifts in the weeks and months ahead. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop and see if there's any questions. I know that the author of the bill mentioned earlier that if, and I want to emphasize, if the university was forced, and as you know, we have a lease in the Metrodome through 2011. If the Vikings and the Twins, and it's principally the Vikings, vacate that stadium and the Twins are gone, the university would be, of course, left with it, and left with a sizable, or someone, probably not the university, but someone will be left with a sizable bill to operate that stadium. We don't currently pay much, and we're not much of a financial drain on the stadium. It really is the Vikings that flip the bill to make that stadium operate. That is not a cost that the university can afford to assume, and frankly, our judgment is that what you would be providing us in an annual appropriation is about equal to what we think it would cost to stay in the dome beyond 2011. With that, I'll stop and see if there's any questions. I can also answer any details you may have about our TCF naming agreement or additional details about what we're talking with the students on.
Thank you. We have Representative Cox. You have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fitzenreiter, the Twin City Federal has come forward on the naming. Have you got a deadline where they're wanting to have some action on the part of the state or part of the legislature here to show that we think this is a good plan and something that could be supported before they would start turning a little squishy there with that level of funding?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in our negotiations with TCF, they were very concerned about this dragging on and on and on, in which the state wouldn't ask. They have come up to the table, so they wanted, and we agreed to a December 31 of 2005 sunset on their naming offer. And that is part of the agreement.
Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate the bill coming forward. I hope this is the first of two football stadiums we decide to build this year. And I'm glad to see the first one here rolled out in front of us today. There'll be more to come, I hope. I have two questions, Mr. Chair. One is on that donation part, just trying to dissect the little fiscal you gave us here. The sponsorships and fundraising is $75 million, and that would be, is that present value? And I'm just getting at the $35 million gift. Is that the present value about $25 million or something, I suppose, or 20?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on the work we've done on the naming of the $35 million, it's my estimate that the university can turn that into approximately $20 million in terms of debt I can issue that I can support with the revenue stream from TCF. The remaining, what one could say, $55 million on here will, of course, depend on how much of that is given up front, which is something we're emphasizing in all of our negotiations. Provide cash on the barrelheads better than debt.
Okay, I appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
And then in the original author's amendment, you deleted section 4. I presume that would be done anyway. It was only a suggestive language that suggests that that you should do that, and I presume they would do that anyway, so it's a technical change.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, as I understand it, the university is currently working with the city of Minneapolis, and the university has been named lead agency for putting together the environmental assessment worksheet, and if it has to go to an EIS, the university would do that too. So it was basically language in the bill that really didn't need to be there because of the cooperation between the city and the university.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. I guess I had a few questions. I'm back in. I have two committees, so I apologize. We're solving the mesh problem elsewhere today. Have you discussed what happens if there's an overrun? The state's firm 40%, and was that discussed? And I'm sorry, I was absent if it was.
Representative Abrams?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, the state's share is limited to $7 million per year for the bonds, and the bonds are limited that can be issued against the $7 million to $94 million. So there's two levels of protection. So if, let's say the $7 million could issue $120 million worth of bonds, they can't do that. They can only issue $94 million of bonds, number one, and the state's contribution is limited to $7 million per year for 25 years, starting in the out biennium, starting with 08-09.
Thank you.
Any other questions for two witnesses? Representative Mariani?
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fitzgerald, I apologize for coming in late, but I had a bit of a briefing prior to this. The bonds are $7 million a year. Cost to the general fund here for the state's 40% share. You said something toward the end of your testimony about the current lease and doing a comparison of that number to the current lease in the out years. Can you just run that through me again? What's the apples to apples?
Mr. Chairman, members, I have been asked questions over the course of this bill. Why doesn't the university just stay in the dome? The Vikings will leave, the Twins will leave, why don't you just stay in the dome? And our concern, we went and took a look at that, our concern was that who's going to pay to keep that place operating over the long haul if we stay? And our assessment in working with the Metropolitan Sports Facility Commission is that expense could be somewhere $6 to $8 million. So my comparison is, if we stay, I think I don't know where the Metropolitan Sports Facility Commission would get that money, and I presume they would turn around and look at the state, and we're simply pointing out that either pay there or pay us, and I think it's better to pay us to build a new stadium. I will also add that our assessment of the dome has a sizable deferred renewal problem coming as well that is going to have to be addressed.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Fitzgerald, and currently, and I can follow up later, but currently the yearly out-of-pocket expenses to University of Minnesota in the dome are...
Mr. Fitzgerald?
extremely small. It is really the, you know, I won't make the advertisement for the Vikings, but in working with the Vikings on over the years on the joint stadium ideas, the Vikings really do foot the bill in the dome. The Twins don't really pay much, if anything, and we don't pay much, if anything. It's really the Vikings who support that facility for all of us.
And Mr. Chair, final question.
The $6 to $8 million
that it, we're estimating would pay to operate in the out years here of the Metrodome, that's something that, how does that match up with the University of Minnesota's receipts? You make money, or at least you bring in revenue through the football program. Is that more than what you bring in? Is that not a sustainable?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do have, I believe it's roughly $5 to $6 million of annual revenues from the football program that support not only the football program at the university, but men's and women's intercollegiate athletics. Okay. So a diversion of that would create a financial problem.
Thank you.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, and I apologize if this was addressed before I got into the meeting, but Coach Mason, did you address the prospects of attending the Rose Bowl if we do this?
Coach Mason.
I'm not sure I addressed it, but I think it was addressed, yeah.
Just to make sure it was.
Yeah.
Representative Eastman, any football questions?
Football question.
Representative
Lass. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Abrams, I note that you had an author's amendment here. I don't know if you had a chance to go through some of the specifics of what it does, but one of the items I recognize on page 4 is that it deletes the authority for a for an intoxicating on-sale liquor license for use in the spectator suites and clubs at the stadium. Could you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Blatts, the reason for the amendment is that I believe that that ought to be handled as part of the omnibus liquor bill and shouldn't be part of the stadium bill. And, you know, it's something that I'm sure the university is going to come forward with. But I just, you know, we normally don't issue liquor licenses in individual pieces of legislation. That's why they call it the omnibus liquor bill.
We have a response from this.
Mr. Chairman, members, I do want to make sure that folks understand when they see that provision at another time, that this was a provision that allowed us to serve alcohol only in the clubs and the suites, not to the general public. I will remind you that the general public can purchase beer in the Metrodome. That is not our plan. This was simply for the suites and the clubs only.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to express my astonishment that alcoholic beverages would be available on a college campus. I was kidding. Come on.
I got it.
Maybe I'm just closer to having been a student on a college campus than campus here. I don't know.
There was never any at St. Cloud State.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I need to regain control here. Yes, Representative Lass.
I just want to make a statement that I grew up attending games at Memorial Stadium, and this looks suspiciously similar to Memorial Stadium. A lot of great afternoons there, great football, great community camaraderie. I sat on both sides of the field enjoyed the perspective from the visitor's side often as well as from the center of the home side. It's a wonderful experience, and I hope that someday every student at the University of Minnesota can enjoy a similar experience. I will note I got my undergraduate degree at Madison, which still has an outdoor football stadium on campus, and it is most definitely a very significant part of the college experience and the college community. I hope that we have a chance to recreate that here. I have conditioned my support for any state public financing for any stadiums on making sure that the University of Minnesota Stadium is taken care of as a first priority, and I'm hopeful that we can get that done in the session.
Just a quick question. You sell a fair number of season tickets now. Any approximate, what's the percentage of season ticket holders do you have for football? My son happens to have four seats. I just wondered if anybody else would think.
18,000 season tickets out of the 62.
Okay. And I would maybe expect this might increase more of those season ticket holders.
Mr. Chairman, members, we sure hope so.
Yeah, good. Any other questions for these two? Representative Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, I've got the math bill up to
place. How's it going?
Been back to the book for a little while. The question I have, and if it's been asked by someone earlier, then I can get the answer later. But I did have a conversation the other day with Donna Peterson, who represents the university, and the only area that I did have a little concern about was the provision where there may be some charge for student fees and so on. And my question is, what kind of a fee would be charged? Not every student necessarily would be going to the games, or what would be the ultimate trade-off? You said there might be some possibility that students would get some reduced tickets or something in exchange, at least those that are interested. But if you could just explain that a little bit more, if you haven't already.
Mr. Fitzreiter.
Mr. Chairman, members, we are, of course, in the financial strategy for this stadium, considering a $50 per semester student fee that would be charged to all undergraduate, graduate, professional students. Nothing is finalized yet. We're still in consultation with the student groups. But in exchange for that charge, we feel very strongly that some kind of, I guess for lack of a better word, fulfillment package or some suite of benefits for the students, reduced ticket prices, certainly preferred seating sections, access to other non-revenue sports, games, things like that, that we could provide the students. I do have and can follow up later with you. I have Liz Ewell here, the CFO from Department of Intercollegiate Athletics, that could address it now, but we could talk later. But we are looking at a suite of benefits for the students. It's not simply like give us money and not anything in return.
Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I support the direction of the bill and will be supporting it a little later. I do have a concern about that. Yeah, that's $100 a year, and probably have a bit more sensitivity to it than maybe I would have in other biennium because of the cost of attendance going up rather rapidly at the university, at least last biennium, and I guess it's yet to be determined what may happen this biennium, so I am a little bit sensitive to the overall cost, and I would like to learn more then about what some of those benefits would be.
Sure.
So I'd ask for that $100 fee.
Mr. Chairman, members, the other thing to bear in mind here is we're very sensitive to the cost and do want to provide a benefit package to them. We also plan to, in the financing strategy for this, to ramp this fee in probably starting in the fall of 06 on freshmen and then, or freshmen and sophomores. So at least students that, when the stadium opens, will, who benefit from it, not trying to start it on students who will have left the university by then, by the time it opens. So another factor in it. But we'll get something around to you on the benefits.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, Representative Abrams, do you have some other testifiers for or against?
I don't know if there's anybody against it, but I'm happy to see if there are any witnesses who feel compelled.
I don't see anybody jumping up.
Mr. Chairman, I will renew my motion and House Bill 263 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the committee on taxes.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. we don't have a fiscal note on the bill. When I was briefed earlier, I was told that major impacts to the general fund would be in the out years because of the releasing of the bonds. obviously there's a bit of a risk on our part that a future legislature may not think we're more smarter than we are on this issue, although I think politically it would be pretty tough to, you know, retroactively tell the University of Minnesota no after we've told them yes. And I do support this effort in this bill. My question is probably more to the chair, Mr. Chair. My question is probably more to you and maybe to our staff. What impact, if any, does this bill have on this committee's targets for this biennium? Should we expect that there be any impact?
I don't believe there'd be any.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Also, to answer my friend Representative Mariani a little bit, I was opposed to the Target Center bill, which has an open and standing $750,000 corporation in the city of Minneapolis dealing with its financing. There have been efforts to take that out in the past, but I, together with I think a fairly large number of people who opposed the bill to begin with, have voted against those efforts, simply because, you know, once a question has been decided, it ought to remain decided. And there are other instances within statute in which there are open and standing. I would really think that if people change their position based upon action by this legislature and doctor issue, et cetera, that it would be a really unusual legislator who would go after an open and standing of that nature.
Okay, that covers all questions. Okay, Representative Abrams has renewed his motion that House File 263 pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Cool.
It's passed. It is amended.
Thanks.
Thank you. Members, we're going to skip down to House File 2224, 2224, in a moment.
Half an hour after session.
But for $20 million,
it's easy. Education tax. No
problem. No,
check with those who do, we should be.
No,
we need 200.
Did they ask it? Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
For the committee.
Good to be here.
I'd like to move your bill.
I'd like to move House File 2224 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. House File 2224 is a mixed-use technical bill, and we consider it to be non-controversial. John Ostrom from Minsky is here, and he'll be answering some questions. First, just wanted to quickly go through the bill. Section 1 refers to the Minnesota Academic Scholarship Program. This program is funded through license plates that have the logos of Minnesota colleges on them. We are adding education and nursing to that list of programs that are eligible for the scholarship. We're also making it possible for colleges to award partial scholarships. As it stands now, Mankato State has to wait for enough people to purchase these plates before they have enough money to have a full
full ride. The language allows them then to give partial scholarships. Section 3 of the bill removes the obsolete term adult vocational education. It also says that senior citizens must pay for any materials or personal property needed for the course. Tuition is still free for the seniors. It also says that seniors in a closed enrollment contract course must pay, and that means that if the school has a contract to train employees of a certain company, and one of the employees happens to be a senior, the employee or employer must pay under the terms of the contract. And finally, in Section 5, this section removes obsolete language. It makes community or technical colleges offer diplomas and certificates in every program. Most programs only have a diploma or a certificate, so the language has been changed to reflect that. Those are the three areas, and I would like to turn it over to John Ostrom from MidState.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. There's an A1 amendment that puts the bill in shape here, and I could answer questions about any of these areas. But first of all, the license plate issue. Most people actually wonder probably how you get a license plate with a college logo on it, and it's about a 10-year-old bill that was passed earlier. And we'd like to accelerate the use of that and have brought forward these changes that will make it easier to get that license plate. Currently, as Representative Nordis indicated, in the A1 amendment, we want to make it clear to the campuses that they can offer the scholarship to anyone for any major after they make the decision about who to offer it to. They could be enrolled in any kind of a college program. And secondly, the amendment permits the institution not to renew it, but they could if they wanted to. These scholarships are worth about, the way it's currently drafted, almost $4,500. And that's a lot of license plates at $25 each. Plus, the campus is required to keep in reserve a mandatory 3-year renewal. And you can see in the A1 amendment on line 18, Representative Nornes wanted to change that to that they may be renewed annually. So that's the first change, and would appreciate your support there.
Why don't we move that?
Move the A1 amendment? Okay.
Is there any discussion of the A1 amendment? Oh, Representative Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nornes, or sir. I'm noticing that the A1 amendment deletes much of the language, lines 10 to 14 on page 1. They say scholarship can be awarded in any field of study, yet there apparently are still limited fields of study specified in subdivision 1 of that same section of statute that's reflected on page 1 of the main bill. Is that an inconsistency, or am I not reading it correctly?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Latz, I made a mistake in Section 1 originally. Section 1 in the drafted bill is the criteria that a high school student must excel in prior to being picked as a recipient. And that I don't need to change. And so we made it clear that once the student is chosen, having excelled in English and fine arts and so on, as a high school student, that they could actually have that scholarship for any field they choose, engineering or teaching or nursing or any field at the college or in this case at the university. So I made a mistake, and Council Novak and others helped me out with that. So,
Representative Kowalski. Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Lance, I carried the legislation, the initial legislation that established the license plate scholarships. They were intended to be academic scholarships. The base amount was $25, but you could go over $25. If a campus decided to charge more, you could charge more. The university had sometimes charged significantly more for the license plates to create these funds. The promotion of it has been a problem. I would agree that the campuses have not picked it up as we would have liked to. However, perhaps recent funding issues may entice them to use this as a promotion if we loosen it up a little bit. But I want to make it clear that the intent of the legislation was an academic scholarship, not an athletic scholarship, and that it was to be created with a minimum of 25. But you could, if the campuses could afford it, you could offer more.
Any other discussion on the A1 amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It is adopted. Any other discussion of the bill? If not, Representative Nornes renews his motion that House File 224, as amended, be recommended to pass and rolled into the omnibus. For consideration in the omnibus. Mm-hmm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. Opposed? I'm not sure we need to make that motion, but.
Thank you. All right.
Can
I just stay here?
I'm just going to recess till half an hour after session. Oh, okay.
You can go ahead and
Recess.
Until after session.
We'll be in recess until 30 minutes after the end of session today. So we're in recess.
We'd like to reconvene the House Higher Education Finance Committee. And we have two bills for consideration this afternoon, beginning with House File Rule 2013. And I will move that bill and for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an A2 amendment, which is an agreement to do with faculty representation. I'd like to pass it up.
Okay, I'll move the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, what that amounts to is some protection kind of language so that whether it's a labor agreement or a contractual arrangement, anything that could affect that would have to come back here and take into account all these factors I mentioned in the amendment.
Any questions? All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Have to speak up.
Apparently, I got to get louder.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make a brief introduction, and I want some really important people from Rochester who have great depth in the background to speak to you. What I want to sort of emphasize, really, is a history that has evolved in a community where some 30,000 plus people come every day for some great jobs in the medical field and the high-tech field. We are in the shadow, and many of you were there in Rochester for the State of the State address in Rochester, and maybe even had a chance to tour some things, and even the facility that you were at, in some measure, is sort of a sign of the times as far as technology is concerned. We have a world-class medical provider, medical researcher in Mayo Clinic, that has, just in Rochester, some 28,000 plus employees. By most members, we think, might be the largest private employer in Minnesota, but also is a miracle maker in terms of the kind of research and the products that come out of that. In addition to that, if you've seen news not in the fairly recent past, the fastest supercomputer in the world is in our backyard. I'm proud to say right in the middle of Hospital 29B that I serve, and that's IBM. In that kind of setting, we have many of the critical success factors working for us, but one of them that is beginning to crack is the whole notion of how critical higher education is. There's no question that if you're going to attract world-class researchers, world-class leading people to work, that amongst the many things that a community has to be strong in is higher education. We are at a point where that's becoming for us a kind of a critical factor that makes a difference. Sometimes in recruiting people, as a matter of fact, we lose them because we don't have the kind of offerings that they would expect to see in a community of our size. I've had a personal story of recruiting people with IBM and bringing them to Rochester to be interviewed and only to lose them because themselves or their spouse saw that they just didn't have the upper division graduate kind of expectations that they expected to see. In the meantime, if you look at it, I think that the Rochester area is probably one of the, on a national level, one of the most creative systems in the world. We call it the 3-2-1. It's three institutions. That is our Rochester Community and Technical College, which is a world-class community and technical college, one of the most successful in the system. It's Winona State University, which has done a marvelous job and would continue a marvelous job in areas like nursing, training, like that. And then finally, we have the University of Minnesota that's been a growing partner little by little in offering some of the coursework in the areas we're talking about. That's three institutions, two systems, both MinSCU and the University of Minnesota, on one site that we call the University Center Rochester. And we've had a study that's done, been done, an exhaustive study that's been done, that really shows us, and Mr. DeBoer will speak more to that because he led that study, that shows us that we're at a point where that model just isn't going to carry us into the future. Mr. Chair, I'm just going to mention briefly, and I would prefer if you could hear testimony and come back to this question that I'm doing, but the deal itself is relatively straightforward. It calls for the appointment of a development committee appointed by the governor with 11 members, a trustee of the Minnesota State College, a regent from the University of Minnesota, six persons from the Rochester area, a commissioner of finance and a committee designee, a person who had expertise in post-secondary finance and planning, and a person who had expertise in post-secondary academic planning and programming. That group, that development group, would have the kind of twofold responsibility of sort of pulling together. We've done a lot of study, and so we're as a community, I don't think we're very interested in just another massive study. We've had plenty of those. I think that in many measures, we sort of know where we need to head. It's time to sort of put that into an organization, a way to make it happen, a way to finance, a way to build partnerships, and then move quickly into the next phase, which is the implementation phase, to give sort of a supercharge, if you will, to the next step of higher education offerings, with the target and focus being in upper division, not to take a thing away, because we expect that the community college will remain in the upper division and graduate work. And that's the second phase. The total amount that would be in the budget if it's fully funded would be the $3.2 million. And that's basically the bill. If the chair is willing, please, I'd like to call upon the board as our first testifier, but then we'll have a number of additional people from IBM, from PEMSTAR, from NAIL, and a representative of the High Tech Council. So if we could proceed with that, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's fine. I should point out that several of our members serve in Ways and Means, and they're working with meth right now, or prevention. Yes. So we're trying to spread everyone out here and get some of this work done.
So. Working with meth to a little different approach?
Working to eliminate meth.
There you go.
Yes. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Representative Nornes and members of the committee, my name is Al DeBoer. I'm a member of the Rochester community. During my working life, I have both practiced law and been actively engaged in running a business in Rochester. Thank you for making time to hear firsthand about the needs for higher education in Rochester and southeastern Minnesota. In the mid-1980s, Rochester completed a study known as FutureScan that identified higher education as a critical need for economic success in the Rochester and southeastern Minnesota area. Out of that community-inspired study was born GROWC, the Greater Rochester Area University Center, that we affectionately or sometimes inaffectionately call GROWC, and that was in 1987, to advocate for higher education. GROWC was and remains funded rather modestly, I might add, by the city, county, and the private sector. It is in my role as a member of GROWC and as chair of their higher education task force that I appear before you today. Growth in higher education in southeast Minnesota has been evolutionary. We have, as Representative Bradley has mentioned, a very fine Rochester Community and Technical College that was itself a result of a merger between the community college and technical systems. We also have offering a range of upper division and courses in Rochester, Winona State University, particularly in the area of nursing, but also in computer science and teacher education. And then the University of Minnesota, which offers graduate programs in engineering and technology, management and nursing. Today, University Center, with these three partners, and as is mentioned, we call this 321, is the sixth largest public education, higher education campus in the state of Minnesota. To get where we are today, Brock and the Rochester community has urged two separate historic agreements between the two higher education systems in Minnesota, MexView and the university. The first created a provost that reported to both systems. This died within 2 years, primarily due to lack of funding and resources to provide the leadership that was really needed to make that arrangement work. The second was legislative action in 1999 that authorized creation of University of Minnesota Rochester Branch Campus. This did result in the appointment of a provost for Rochester on behalf of the university and a leadership team to implement some programs to meet local needs. The downside of that arrangement was that funding was stripped from the bill, and the University of Minnesota was asked to deliver extensive programs, again, primarily in the upper division and graduate levels, without the needed resources. Today, we're reaching the limits of the 3-2-1 collaborative model. Our providers, our three main providers, while working hard and growing programs, simply cannot respond quickly enough and lack the tools and resources to meet our economic and market needs in Rochester and in the area. If you think about it, dramatic changes have occurred in our economic base since our advocacy at Grout began in 1987. There is a confluence of computation, genomics, and life sciences and technology. There's been growth in the workforce and the need to attract new talent from outside the region. We've absorbed that which is available in the region and trained for these jobs. There's been a changing technology that requires more incumbent worker education, a phenomenon that I think we're all familiar with. Then we have curriculum needs driven from innovation in medical and computer sciences, which are needed for our state and nation, subjects such as bioinformatics. Today you will hear more about all these requirements from Rochester business leaders representing Mayo, PEMSTAR, and IBM. They are not the only ones who could, would and could speak to these issues, I might add. We have some 40 startup technology companies who have made Rochester our home, but the ones that are speaking today are representative. Rochester needs, and not wants, but needs, greater identity and visibility for higher education. A magnet, if you will, to attract talent and to encourage incumbent workers to advance their education. We need stronger governance and clear management and leadership to drive the public's investment in higher education and align the unique requirements of our region. This bill speaks directly to that by charging the Development Commission to come up with a clear management and governance tool. Right now, the 3-2-1 system simply is not functioning as it needs to. We also need a financial model to enable strategic growth and an ongoing investment opportunity to build upon our current base. The 3-2-1 model just simply doesn't work. We have to reinvent something that will work where we have three institutions, two systems, operating in the higher education milieu in Rochester. And we need some startup funds to build new programs and catch up with economic development needs. The bill before you requests $3.2 million. $200,000 of this for planning purposes to be utilized by the Development Committee to carry out its mandates, and $3 million for the development and implementation of various economic programs contemplated during the course of this biennium and beyond. The programmatic matters are reasonably well known in our community, particularly in the health sciences and technology. That won't take a lot of time to figure out. We've studied that part of it to death. The more difficult agenda will be the governance, management, and financial models required to position this higher education facility for the success we envision. We cannot delay the development of the programs because time really is of the essence. The bill recognizes this by requiring a report back to the governor and legislature by January 15th of next year. Thus, the planning for the form and substance of this proposal can proceed in tandem so that implementation of some of the economic programs can commence during this biennium. It's also important to note, I think, what we're not asking for. This is not a request for a new, quote-unquote, four-year university with a football team, cheerleaders, and all the rest. As much as some people would like those things and want those things, quite frankly, that's not what we're about. Rochester is asking for an entity with innovative and strategic baccalaureate and graduate programs that serve our local economy and our state. We studied this situation for years, and we are here to advocate for the legislation proposed, which will create an implementation team that can invent and shape this solution, which will target, in an academic sense, the health sciences, technology, management, and agribusiness areas. Rochester's need is best described by the panel today representing those key industries that I mentioned. In addition, Kate Rubin of the Minnesota High Tech Association will address the issue from a broader statewide perspective. And we are pleased that Ms. Rubin could join us today. I should mention that Commissioner Kramer of the Department of Economic Development addressed the Senate Higher Education Committee presenting the statewide perspective and spoke enthusiastically in support of this initiative. He was unable to be with us today, but as I say, we're pleased that Ms. Rubin can join us. Thank you for your patience in allowing me to present an overview of the case for advancing higher education in Rochester. And then we would ask Representative Bradley for the other representatives to come forward. I think Kathy Meyerly is going to be first.
Anyone have any questions of Mr. DeBoer before you? You can come back maybe later.
I'd be happy to come back. I think we've got some other folks who would like to speak to more specific items.
Very good. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Meyerly. I'm an attorney at Mayo Clinic. I sit on their public affairs committee, and I'm also on the faculty of the Mayo Medical School. I'm the course director for the medical jurisprudence course, so I have some interesting perspectives on the bill before you today. I'm pleased to be representing Mayo and Dr. Hugh Smith, who's chair of our Board of Governors, and sends his greetings. Mayo Clinic enthusiastically endorses the bill before you today. The expansion of higher education opportunities in Rochester has been a long-standing goal of my organization. We were one of the original founders of GRAUC, the Greater Rochester Area University Center, and have continued over the last 16 years to try and match the community's needs in higher education with the available resources that we have in our community. As you can appreciate, much of our workforce is place-bound, and we do have a very strong need for Rochester area-based programming. This legislation we view as an exciting new step in the progression that Mr. DeBoer described to you. Mayo Clinic and our health system across southern Minnesota is over 30,000 employees. As you've heard from others and in probably different forums, Rochester and Mayo is an economic engine for the state, and we hope to continue to do so and be that well into the future. But in addition to being a very large employer and a very large medical provider, we also mission. And so our needs and interests in this legislation come both from our position as an employer and also as a higher education provider ourselves. The Mayo Clinic College of Medicine actually has five schools in it. There is the Mayo School of Graduate Education, which is the postdoctorate training for physicians who spend anywhere from 2 to 7 years in practical training after they complete their medical degrees. The Mayo Graduate School offers master's and doctoral degrees for scientists and researchers in the various health science fields. We have a School of Health Sciences, which trains over 27 allied health professionals. And we have the School of Continuing Medical Education, which provides continuing education courses for a number of health professionals, physicians, nurses, and others. And then, of course, we have the Mayo Medical School, which graduates 40 medical doctors each year from its school. These, as you can see, the programming and the coursework that we offer ranges from the very basic level certificate programs all the way up to doctoral degrees. Many of our programs at the School of Health Sciences and at the medical school are done in conjunction with the three University Center Rochester partners. Rochester Community Technical College provides the didactic work for many of our certificate health sciences programs. Winona State University has the nursing programs with which our hospitals collaborate in providing the clinical training. And two of our newest programs, the ones that we're very excited about, reflect one of the big needs that I think often goes unappreciated, and that is professions which have had an entry-level requirement of education that may have been an associate degree or a certificate, but now through the advances in science and technology are requiring bachelor's degrees for their in order to practice that profession. And so in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Rochester, our School of Health Sciences has started a radiation therapy and a respiratory therapy baccalaureate degrees. Another major need that we have right now, and I believe there's an article in the folder that you have in front of you, talks about an affiliation that our Department of Laboratory Medicine has with North Dakota University to train what we used to call medical technologists but now call clinical laboratory scientists. Mayo actually expects to hire 600 new employees a year for the foreseeable future. Because of the demographics, the change in our workforce needs are going to become even more acute. I have one laboratory director right now that has told me they could hire 41 clinical laboratory specialists, individuals trained in microbiology and virology, the study of viruses. But he does not have applicants for these. So we are recruiting nationwide, but the lack of trained scientific and healthcare workers is clearly an impediment to the growth that we are projecting. Mayo has a strong commitment to our employees and to supporting the higher education endeavors of our employees, either getting that initial degree, completing advanced training, or advancing at the master's or doctoral level in their professions. One of our very significant benefit programs is a tuition reimbursement program that provides partial tuition reimbursement for employees who seek advanced training. In 2004, we committed over $5 million to reimbursing tuition for our employees, and that's just from the Minnesota operations. So we have a tremendous stake in having the highest quality scientific, administrative, and healthcare programs available in our community to benefit our employees, to help secure the future of our institution. We are looking very much forward to working with the Rochester University Development Committee that is proposed in the bill before you today. We think we have some things to offer, and we think the product of that development committee will be very beneficial not only to Mayo, but also to the economic development and the whole future prosperity of the state of Minnesota. So thank you for giving me your time and attention, and I'll respond to questions either now or later as the committee wishes.
I don't see any questions at this time, so stand by. I apologize for the warmth of the room, but it's one thing we can't control, among a lot of other things, too, I guess. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Pleased to be here this afternoon. My name is Al Burning. I'm the chairman and CEO of PEMSTAR, a global company that's headquartered in Rochester, Minnesota. Prior to PEMSTAR, I worked for IBM for 15 years, and also proud to say I'm an engineering and MBA graduate of St. Cloud State University. We employ approximately 700 people in Rochester and around 4,000 worldwide, and I'm here today to represent the entrepreneurial and startup opportunities that we believe can have started and can continue in Rochester. We, for example, started 10 years ago as with the original group coming as part of a transition from IBM. And we're one of dozens of companies that have started in the last 8 to 10 years or moved into Rochester that support technology, medical projects, or both. We happen to do both. We're a technology development and manufacturing company as well as a medical products development and manufacturing company. As many tech jobs have moved to low-cost areas, we see med tech and instrumentation as the best way to keep growing our types of jobs in Minnesota. We've been able to demonstrate that we can do that, and as have other companies in Rochester. We believe it's the critical mass is now just formed to really start accelerating that and creating even more. And I'm particularly thrilled to be part of the Rochester and southeastern Minnesota community at this point. There are a lot of exciting things that are coming together, and those types of things only come together very infrequently, and when they do, you have to take advantage of them. The Mayo Clinic, the U of M, and IBM initiatives on biotech and genomics are a huge opportunity for both the state and the nation. And as running our business, I have the opportunity to travel around a lot and see what's going on in Arizona, California, and Florida. And obviously, many states have invested a significant amount of money in biotech and genomics. However, no other state has the combination that we have with the Mayo Clinic, IBM, and the University of Minnesota initiatives on biotech. So that's something that the state has to realize and look at. How do we better leverage that? As an entrepreneur, this combination can and will create opportunities for dozens of new companies in the region and the state. And one of the examples I like to use, and others have used as part of this, is Austin, Texas. We have a business in Austin, Texas. I've traveled there frequently for the last 15, 20 years. And 25 years ago, Austin, Texas was at a similar crossroads. They were looking at the oil industry at that time starting to decrease and needed something else for as an economic engine for the city and the area. At that time, the city, local business, the state of Texas, and the University of Texas came together to form MCC, a Microelectronics and Computer Tech Corporation, and later an organization called Semitech. Those two organizations began to focus and really gel the critical mass on semiconductors and computers, and that obviously has worked out very well for Austin. It got the critical mass in research together, and it provided what was needed to fuel growth in Austin in those particular industries. Today, there are over 200 tech companies employing more than 95,000 people in Austin, Texas. I go there almost every month, so I see it, and I've been able to see that develop and how that works. Today, semi-tech and computers aren't the industry that we're going to talk about for the next 25 years. It's biotech and genomics are the growth industries. And we have all the same elements in place that Austin did 25 years ago in their respective past. We have it in biotech and genomics. And so the elements are there, and the elements can come together in a way that creates success for the state that was created in Texas. The only missing piece is a well-coordinated higher ed element that particularly can deliver the programs in medical science and tech and leverage the medical and technology research needed to really push this whole thing forward. We appreciate the work and the programs that have been put in place both by Minsky and U of M. President Dennis Ball is here. They've done a great job with the community college and the technical college in terms of funding education and delivering education at that level. So that part works. That base needs to stay in place, and we need to keep growing on that base. What we're talking about and with the opportunity before us requires adding the research and applied elements, particularly in medical and technology, a combination of the two, to achieve the success that is possible in both genomics and biotech. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Nice to meet you, Lynn.
Okay. Welcome. And, identify yourself for the record.
Okay, sure. My name is Walt Lang. I'm a senior vice president for IBM and senior state executive here for IBM in the state of Minnesota. So I wanted to share a couple of thoughts from IBM's perspective here on the same issue. First, just as a way of introducing myself as well, I've been with IBM just under 28 years and in the Minnesota area for about 13 of those. and our senior state executive here for about four. So this issue has been around for some time, and we've made some good progress, but we've got further to go. We really have three points that we'd like to clarify. One is the importance of growing the presence in Rochester from a recruitment standpoint. Fran mentioned a little bit about that earlier. From a retention standpoint, continuing to keep our employees educated so they can continue to contribute to the new businesses that we get into, and then the whole area of research as well. In the area of recruitment, we recruit from across the United States for undergraduates come to work for IBM. And there are a number of challenges to get people to come for the first time and perhaps to stay for more than a few days, the weather not being the least of those. But one of the things that was mentioned earlier and we wanted to reinforce as well is that the ability for us to be able to talk to college recruits or people that come in with master's degrees and want to continue their education, what opportunities are available for them here. And, you know, we know what the answer is. And it takes about a half an hour to explain the 3-2-1 to a young person coming here for the first time and trying to get that whole point across. It's hard enough for us to understand it, much less someone who's, you know, looking at different employers and different locations to have that employment opportunity. When we look at some of our other major research and development organizations across IBM in the United States alone, every one of them is paired up with a major research university. So we've made some good progress here in Rochester, but we have ways to go. Now we look at the whole area of retention. We have about $3.5 million per year that we spend on education programs, continuing education programs for our employees. In fact, we spent about $3.5 million of in-house education that we've developed, and about $3.5 million for people to take courses at various colleges and universities. And about half of that goes to the University of Minnesota in Rochester, and the other half to a number of other institutions. We'd like to continue to have those funds go towards areas of new science, new technology, bioinformatics, biology programs and such, so that we can continue to work in some of the new areas that we're getting into. We believe in order to retain our competitive posture in this global marketplace as well, that we have to be able to align and provide better flexible education and serve more of the needs of IBM and for the state. Now, the whole area of research, today we enjoy a significant research partnership with the Mayo Clinic in the area of bioinformatics. And we've been using some of our advanced database and data mining capabilities within IBM to allow access and discovery across the Mayo's diverse and extensive medical records. This is really working out to be a great synergy between the strengths of Mayo Clinic and of IBM. The synergy that exists is really unlike anything we've experienced in Rochester, because it's coming from these two areas of leading-edge technology. We also have an extensive relationship with the U of M. Since 72, IBM has invested significantly, almost $29 million in the U of M, for things like graduate fellowships, faculty research awards, specialty projects in technology, and most recently investments in Minnesota Supercomputing Institute through IBM's Shared University Research Program. U of M is valued as a Tier 1 university partner for IBM worldwide, so we invest in terms of research, and we also look to acquire as many of their excellent graduates as possible to come into the IBM company. Now, we're developing a Center for Advanced Studies in which Rochester would become the Center for Excellence for IBM on a worldwide basis in the areas of life sciences and deep computing. So we're making the investments, we're learning new things, we're on the bleeding edge of these technologies. 2 weeks ago, we announced that IBM Rochester is going to also host an on-demand computing facility featuring our BlueJean product, the world's fastest supercomputer. BlueJean provides the compute power necessary to solve some of these complex problems, including those found in life sciences, research, genomics, etc. So if we're going to maintain our flagship research university, strengthening the ties with Rochester, where we have the deep computing and the medical research at the heart of our economies, makes a lot of good sense for Minnesota. There's a long way of saying that we have an opportunity here. Things are sort of coming together. You've kind of heard that theme, I guess, from several of us, that the opportunities here in terms of supercomputing capabilities, in terms of the whole medical and bioinformatics research areas, and with all the partnerships that we've had established with IBM and the U of M, with IBM and the Mayo Clinic, in the U of M in all these different facets, there's really an opportunity, maybe once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, for us to take advantage of this confluence, these unique skills and capabilities that we have, and really take a leading role in the world. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to talk about some of our needs and get your consideration for some of these things. I know you're dealing with limited resources. Believe me, I understand that. That's what I do every day, dealing with limited resources and trying to figure out how to allocate them as best as possible to help our business grow and our business prosper here in Minnesota. Thanks.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, you may step down.
I have one more testify. If you have sort of the community view, I think Kate Rubin brings sort of an outside view. I was thinking as Walt was testifying, but I remember talking in kilobytes, and now we're talking teraflops. Wonderful world. Yeah, wonderful world.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Kate Rubin, Minneapolis, President of the Minnesota High Tech Association. MHTA has over 300 members who are in industries that range from biotech to advanced manufacturing to information technology, medical devices, and much more. Mr. Chairman, there's one thing I hope that we all agree on, and that's that higher education is incredibly important to the future of this state. And I know that all of you around this table agree with that, because I've had the pleasure of meeting with most of you one-on-one over the last few months about that. As president of MHTA, I meet constantly and have the opportunity to talk about with business leaders about what's important in this state and why they have their businesses here. And time after time, they tell me it's the quality of higher education that we have and that that's one of the most important things for continuing to keep their businesses here. In fact, just 2 hours ago, many of the people in this room and the business leaders and I were around a table for a couple hours talking about the future needs of the Minsky system and polytechnic needs, as well as centers of excellence. That's why I'm here before you this afternoon. House File 2013 will research and make recommendations on how to strengthen higher education in Rochester. And Rochester, as you've heard today, is vitally important to our state. It's not just one of the most high-tech centers in Minnesota or in the nation, but in the world. We shouldn't overlook the fact that with Blue Gene technology at IBM, it's now the world's fastest supercomputer, and right next door to one of the world's best medical facilities and research facilities. And as a state, we need to recognize this and do what we can do to encourage the region's success. Technology-related jobs in Rochester are exactly the kinds of jobs that this state needs and we need to help foster. The average private sector wage in Minnesota is $36,000. The average wage for a technology employee in Minnesota is more than $58,000, and that is almost 60% higher than the average wage. Fortunately, Rochester also is well-suited to ride out the bumps in the economic road. During the recent recession, and if you look at the years 2000 to 2003, the state's labor market price profile during that time saw a job loss of 1.2%. During that same time, southeast Minnesota and the Rochester area, the numbers remained flat. There was no net job loss. Because Rochester is the center for high-tech employment, they already have a well-educated population. 86% of the population has a high school diploma, and 54% have some post-secondary education. But Rochester faces two challenges. First, they share the problem with the rest of the nation has relative to job growth and changes on the horizon. Statistics show us that baby boomers will start to retire in 2008, and by the 2012-2013 timeframe, it will reach a turning point. The labor market will be insufficient to supply the workers needed. In fact, job vacancy data indicates the need for 80,000 job replacements in southeast Minnesota by 2010. Half of these jobs will require a BA degree or higher. We need to be able to fill these positions, providing well-trained students for high-tech and medical careers. Additionally, you've heard today that Rochester's economy includes more than 40 startup technology companies in addition to IBM and Mayo, and their workforces need constant and ongoing upskilling or improvement in the technology and medical skills that they have. The dramatic changes that are occurring in both computing and medical research, as well as in medical practice, require this ongoing, constant upgrade of skills. While the existing workforce needs well-educated workers as well. We need to do everything we can to ensure that the higher education provided in Rochester meets the needs of both current employees and businesses, as well as creates that future pipeline of skills necessary to fuel the high-tech startups anticipated. I'm encouraged that this bill sets up a high-level university development committee to flesh out how higher education in Rochester should look into research mechanisms for making that happen and ensuring that the programs offered are aligned with the unique needs and opportunities in Rochester. At the same time, the development committee must be a collaborative effort with the existing higher education entities, university and the MNSCU system, and they must carefully weigh and acknowledge the many, many trade-offs that will inevitably occur. MHTA looks forward to working with this committee to ensure that Rochester area remains a high-tech center in the global economy in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Are there any other testifiers that you're aware of, either for or against? And then we'll questions. Questions.
I know I really appreciate the patience of you, but can you get a feel for sort of the level of complexity and the nature of the community? Because this isn't just today; this is a longer term investment. I appreciate your time with you.
Right, Representative Lopez.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I have a couple of questions, but I want to indicate my support for the needs.
And you want to slide the mic over to the, for the chair, whichever.
Rochester, I think it's sort of an anomaly in history with a community like Rochester, supposed to be that 50 or 100 years, and it wasn't much different than a place like St. Cloud or Vinci, where we have a more substantial higher education infrastructure. So it does seem to me that we need to find a way, the legislature, to help this important community broaden its higher education facilities and infrastructure to meet the demand, but particularly given the unique set of institutions in that community. The one question I had is, you mentioned, Representative Bradley, and I think one or two other people mentioned too, that, and we know that this has been a conversation for a long, long time, and I think there have been other studies that have been done. I'm curious, why is it that instead of asking us for what it is you want, or having a clear set of needs that need to be filled, or we're now you're asking for another study to help the community and the legislature get to that next step. I'm just curious why, what's going on that's not where we're at right now. A very solid, detailed plan given the years and years that your community has been working on.
Representative
Brown. Sure, I think it's a really excellent question, and probably as much as anything, should come to the table. We've begun to feel for some time that building on, because what we've been doing is building on a current structure model, what we call the 3-2-1. Several months ago, I don't know, a year ago, whatever, we began to sense that this isn't going to carry us to the future. And a lot of things coming together. And rather than just sort of because we know academically a lot of things are needed, but it isn't just academics. It isn't just about what courses are offered. It's also about how you sustain it. What organizational model should there be? And many people in the community sort of jump to a conclusion what it might be, but I think the theme was, let's not constrain ourselves, and I think with some encouragement from the governor to say, I'm ready to support you in what you need to move, but we need at least to take the time to sort of look at the governance questions, look at the financial model, look at sort of where this heads us, and put everything you know together into something and come back and share that. And that, I think it makes some sense. Otherwise, we'd have been sort of building the needs on top of the current model. And that's probably not the right thing to do. Now, let's see if I can come close.
Mr. DeBoer?
Well, Senator Opatz, or Representative Opatz and members of the committee, I think that what Representative Bradley has indicated is really pretty much right on. There's no question but what there is a strong desire amongst significant segments of our community to grow the University of Minnesota in Rochester. And that is part and parcel of this. But that standing alone isn't going to solve the problems, because what we, our premise in this initiative is to build on the base. And that includes both RCTC and Winona State. And because we have three different major institutions delivering those services, and we have two different systems delivering those services, it gets very complex, the kind of fiscal models that you build a university on. Most people are their mindset is a 1-1-1. They've got one institution with one system on one campus. That you can get your arms around and deal with, but you just think of the fiscal models that are needed to sustain and grow a university. Lower division courses traditionally help subsidize upper division courses, but in Rochester, it doesn't work that way, because we don't have the models there to do that. We've got a lower division school and we've got a couple upper division schools, and so we've got to create. And this is where the study part comes in. It's not studying as much what we need from an academic perspective as it is studying the structure that's to be given to the governance and management of this institution that's to be formed, so that it'll work. Right now, it just doesn't work very well. There's a lot of different examples of why it doesn't work, and I think I've alluded at least to some of them, but we just have to have something that works, and we have to have a fiscal model that also will fit into that, so that when we work together, these institutions going down the road, it can be a win-win-win for everybody, but at the end of the day, it's got to be a win for the state of Minnesota, and it's got to be strategic and all of those things. That's what the study part of it is about, is the structure of this thing and how it's going to look when we're done with it. We need help in that.
Representative Wilcox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's sort of got to my next question, which is, has to do with on the page 4. The second bullet, provide initial funding for academic program development. I'm confused a little bit about what's going on here. One is this effort to create a plan, I guess, put together a plan that you then come back to the legislature for. But then with respect to this item, while you're developing a plan, you're actually implementing something. And I'm just curious, how do you know what it is you'd be implementing developing in terms of academic programs? I mean, I understand, and we've heard some of this, that there's a pretty obvious set of sort of some things that you know you're going to want to do and need to do and meet the demands of IBM and Mayo and what, but it does seem that there's the cart coming a little bit before the horse, that we're going to come back here in a year to say, here's our plan, while you're actually doing something that I assume would reflect the plan.
I think that's a good question, Representative Opatz, and one that on the face of it doesn't seem to kind of square itself. But in reality, as I've mentioned, the planning part really relates to structure. And while that is being addressed, and this is on a fast track, I mean, we're asked, the legislation says, come back by January with the solution to that idea. In the meantime, some of the academic programming that we know is needed can go on. That's the easy part, is the academic program part. We don't need a study to tell us what the academic programming needs are, where the critical areas are that aren't currently being addressed. But that can happen in tandem, and it's also intended to cover the biennium. We don't want to wait another 2 or 4 years to kind of get this thing going. We've been there before in this sense, and that we had structures created, even though they maybe weren't perfect. But the idea of the 4 in 99 was that the University of Minnesota was going to come in and do all these things, but then the funding was stripped out of it and nothing has happened. We want to continue the programmatic aspects of this thing And as soon as a, kind of in a dual track here, so that some of the programming planning can go in tandem, if you will, with the studies that are going to come out and tell us what the structure ought to be. So yes, the plan that they come back with is going to be in January, but we need to be working now and starting with the advice and counsel and knowledge of the commission of some of the programmatic things. And the funding, by the way, is not controlled by the development committee per se, but it's the funding is coming from HESO, so they're going to control the funds. So as if programs were developed before the final plan is in, HESO would have control of those funds along the way. But what we really want is when this thing comes in January, we want to be able to hit the road and start running. We don't want to have to wait 2 years. And if you think about it, $3 million to grow a program that we have in Rochester right now, where you may have the base that's provided, to grow an academic program will cost about $250,000. So, and we've identified a number of programs, and you know, $3 million, if you use that number, you're looking at about 12 different academic programs, which isn't really a lot in the context of what we're talking about. So it's just a start to get started down this road of that development process.
Representative Opetz.
I don't want to dominate this, but just one last issue. And with respect to the way you structured the council,
it's the development committee, according to legislation.
And I don't want to second-guess you, Representative Bradley, but I assume that one of the concerns of that committee will be whatever they come up with, it is something that can be sold back to us legitimately here at the legislature. But you didn't do what we often see done when we put together these kinds of commissions, and that is include some legislative representation. Can you just share your thoughts on
Who wants to address that? Representative Bradley?
I think one of the conditions that we expect to do this is not to make this your typical 30, 40, 50 person kind of committee, that you can be lean, quick moving, and so forth. And my hunch is that there'll be a number of us from the area legislatively that will be watching, but I don't know how critical it really is to be directly at the table. So it hasn't really come up before, and at least on a personal level, I'm satisfied to have good, strong representatives from the community that aren't, let's say, diverted by many other legislative activities, and to keep in touch. So I'm satisfied with that.
Thank you.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have two questions, and they're really not to the author or to the testifiers, but they do piggyback on what Representative Opetz brought up with the need, and it has been a point that I agree, if there's a need in Rochester and we haven't addressed it, we should. Given the testimony from the University of Minnesota and Minsky that we've had in this division over the last 3 months, my questions are this. First of all, could the University of Minnesota come up and tell me in specificity what particular need that the university has not met in Rochester, what program that the university has not provided, and a reason for not providing that program or programs? And I would like this from the university, if possible, not from the testifiers, but from the university. And if Minsky's here, I would ask the same question. What particular need in Rochester has not been met that has been asked for by Rochester for whatever reasons? Could you provide that? And then, secondly, while you're up, can you tell me how this process will facilitate meeting that need? So if the university or Minsky could answer those two questions, that would be appreciated.
Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Robert Jones, Senior Vice President for Assistant Administration, University of Minnesota.
Did you get the question pretty much, or do you need
I think I got the representative.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and what was your name again? I'm sorry.
Robert Jones, okay. Senior Vice President for Assistant Administration, University of Minnesota. I'm not sure if I can, Representative Velasquez, I'm not sure if I can lay out for you the specific academic needs of the community that have been met. I've been involved with providing some administrative oversight for this campus for about a year now. But it's very, very clear to us from the conversations we've had with Grok. I've made several visits to the campus and had conversations with David Carl, the provost for that campus, and with the different advisory committees. And it's very, very apparent that there are academic programs that we could potentially grow in the Rochester community that would be courses or academic programs principally offered by the University of Minnesota. But the fact of the matter is that we have not had the resources to invest in growing those new programs. I mean, we've been very, very successful, I think, in growing some new programs and MBA programs, some programs in nursing. And clearly, I think that there are some other programs that clearly meet the special niche of that community in the healthcare area, biotechnology, computer technology, and other kinds of academic programs we could certainly offer if, in fact, we had the resources to do so.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pallas.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jones, thank you. I appreciate that answer. Now, can you tell me how this bill would facilitate what you need to do for Rochester? If resource is the issue, how does this bill give the university the resources to do that?
Well, Mr. Jones.
Chair, Representative Velasquez, this bill, you know, depending upon how it's structured and how the resources would flow, it's my understanding that there would be some initial resources, as has been stated, that will provide perhaps more structure to the current academic arrangement that exists in Rochester, much more than what we have currently. And as we hear very clearly from the community, that's not adequate. We need more structure there. And I think that's perhaps been one of the stumbling blocks from not being able to invest more resources. If, in fact, this legislation goes through and provides an additional $3 million, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, and in the long term, it's not a lot of resources. But, in fact, as was stated earlier, those resources, if it was appropriated in a way that allows us to grow and to build on the existing programs, I think we can provide provide an extra source of seed money to initiate the developments of some very strong academic programs that help get us farther down the road in terms of trying to provide the academic presence that the community wants and that the community needs.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Jones, I want to be clear. If the $3 million were provided, it would have to be provided on top of what the university is already requesting from us. If we fenced off, let's say, $3 million of your current allocation, I'll use the governor's numbers, if we fenced off $3 million and said the university must spend $3 million on this, would that be adequate? That would mean you'd get $3 million less to spend on the other priorities within the university's budget.
Representative Velasquez, clearly, if we are to grow additional academic programs in Rochester at this juncture, it would require an investment of additional resources. Our budget has been pretty much set for the next biennium. Myself, along with a number of my colleagues in the audience today, worked very hard in preparing our biennium request. And as you know, it's a partnership agreement that involves reallocating substantial resources from our current budget in order to balance the budget for the next 2 years. It does not include a reallocation of resources to support new academic programs in Rochester.
Mr. Chair,
it would require new resources.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jones.
I represent.
Thank you. That's almost exactly the same answer that President Brunix gave. So
you trained me well.
Yeah, good. well done. Okay.
Representative Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for arriving late, and so if you've been over some of this already, I'm sorry, but I do have some questions regarding the bill itself. I don't know if this is for Representative Bradley or someone else in a position to respond. Do you need to?
Oh, I just have to be someplace else. You know how that goes. Well, go ahead.
Right. On page one of the bill, it defines the membership of the proposed committee. And I don't see any membership including members of the faculty of either Minsky or the University of Minnesota. Is there a particular reason why the faculty were not included?
If so, why is that?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's, I don't think there's any particular reason. Again, I'll go back to, as I understood, we're really trying to have this be a, remember, this is one that's got to come back by January of next year. If you were to say faculty, remember the model we just talked about? Which faculty? Now, does that mean that you go to three different faculty members to represent each of the institutions? There'll be strong community membership here. There is system membership, you notice that on there. So I think that this just sort of fit a small group, a good cross-section of community, academic leaders. But on the subject of faculty, if you did go there, I don't know that it was any particular call on that. The immediate question is then which faculty? And I don't know that it would be predicted. I mean, you could end up growing this committee by another third or so if you were trying to satisfy all the faculties that are involved here. And that wouldn't necessarily be right for trying to move this thing along quickly.
Representative Blatz.
Mr. Chairman, it just strikes me that since the faculty would be such an integral part of delivering whatever the product of such a committee would be, that it would make sense to have them involved in the ground floor of planning for it, including planning specific programs, educational programs and courses and stuff like that. Which faculty, that's something that could, I think, be sorted out. I'm not suggesting that six faculty be added to an 11-member committee, but a couple, perhaps, at least one from the U and from Minsky, since maybe Mayo would otherwise be adequately represented because they are already presently heavily involved in Grauk.
Mr. DuBois.
Representative Letts, I think that a couple things. One, picking up on what Representative Bradley mentioned, that if you go down that road, I agree, you can maybe find out which faculty member, then seems to me you probably should have an administrator also, and I don't know where you end in that process. I think that the real answer to that, though, is this, that this so-called development commission will have access and will receive input, I suspect, from a variety of groups. Certainly when you're talking about programs, they're going to get input from the people that help put these programs together, including faculty. So faculty can be a resource to that committee, but doesn't have to sit on the committee. The key issues that, in my mind, the committee must deal with relate to the structure, the governance, the management, and the course offerings that are needed that ultimately become a part of the plan have, in fact, received input from a wide range of people. They're fairly well known. These very quickly could be spelled out and set forth for the committee. So they, in a sense, have already had some input into some of that process. But they would have, rather than sitting on the commission and having it become a broad, larger group, they can be a resource to the committee rather than as a member of it, per se. That's the thinking, anyway.
Okay. Representative Blatz.
Before I follow up, if I may ask, since I didn't catch the original motion, is this moved, possibly being held over for inclusion in the
amendment? That is correct.
Okay. My own instinct is that it would be beneficial to institutionalize the input from the most important stakeholders in this. My guess is some of the designees of the Minsky trustee or the Regents designees, it might in fact be administration, but faculty I don't see otherwise institutionalized into the process. So when we get to the point of working up the omnibus bill, I'd be interested in possibly, just to let you know, to possibly increasing the size of the committee to 13 and designating two of those slots for faculty, one each from Minsky and the U. However they happen to be selected, maybe it's the faculty organizations that would designate that, or however we could work that out. But that would be my instinct at this time. I did have a follow-up question, completely unrelated to that question.
That has to do with the proposed use of the $3 million for the endowment, or possibly for endowment purposes. Could you detail for me a little bit more? There are four categories set forth for how the $3 million might be used. How is it anticipated that that money might be used, and pay particular attention to the question of endowments?
Mr. Chair, I think you've got people who can answer, and I have another point set if I don't get there
okay.
in 2 minutes.
Okay, we understand.
So I'll leave you in good hands.
We'll take good care of your bill while you're gone.
Thank you. That makes me really wonder.
Now that the questions are getting tough, Representative Badley bails out. Representative Latz, I forgot what your question was again.
Use of the $3 million in particular relation to endowment.
Endowment. The endowment was a concept that quite frankly came out of the governor's office. It didn't come out of Rochester. What we've envisioned that is, and I think what we're talking about it as, is program development, academic program development funds, not an endowment in the traditional sense. I think endowment has been used differently here to mean what I just said it was, that is academic program development. I do believe that the Senate bill, the companion bill to this, has modified that somewhat to take the endowment term per se out. But the sense is that it's not an endowment in the pure sense.
Mr. Chairman, in light of that response, and particularly since on page 4, line 2, there is a separate category authorizing use for academic program development, I'm a bit concerned about, say, some small portion of the $3 million actually going for program development, leaving a large portion of $3 million to establish an endowment for some undetermined future purposes, and especially when we have so many other needs for financing. I'm concerned about the fiscal aspect of this, although I certainly understand and respect Rochester's desire for more formalized academic programs. But my inclination right now is to modify this bill, as apparently the Senate has, which would be to remove the endowment provisions in there, and then leave the question of long-term institutional funding, whatever that may turn out to be, for some time after a report were to come back to the legislature. I'm not making any motions at this point. I assume right. that those would be appropriate when we work up the omnibus bill.
Right. That's correct. Representative Plowski.
Mr. Chair, I want to recognize former Representative Dave Bishop, who's here today. I can't imagine why, but might be on this bill. And even to acknowledge something that he said with finances on Rochester Day. I had a group of people from Rochester in my office who had just come from a lunch that Representative Bishop had been at, and apparently you were coaching them on the bus, Representative Bishop. And they told me that you had said, don't ask for any new money until you say fully fund the higher education requests that are being made first, which was, I thought, a very, very good thing to do. But, Mr. Chair, you know what? That night, when we were at the Armory, Representative Bishop came up and opened up his wallet, which, by the way, had a huge wad of cash in it, and took out a small piece of paper and said, this is what I read to the Rochester people on the bus. And it was exactly the same statement. Don't ask for any new money until you fully fund the request that they ask for. And I just thought, Mr. Chair, it was worth repeating and thanking Representative Bishop. He hasn't lost his touch.
Thank you for those comments. Ms. Hager, did you have something?
Mr. Chair, no, I thought I okay. would just keep on the chair.
Chair 1, okay. All right.
I was going to do that.
Did the former representative have something to add to this discussion today? Would you like to, no?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the invitation. I am here
just because I want to see how you deal with this very, very critical issue for Rochester.
Okay.
And I do acknowledge Representative Pulaski's comments to be accurate. I strongly feel that you need to fund the University of Minnesota as well as this item for Rochester.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Oh, Representative Bishop.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. There's an item in the bill I was wondering if someone could respond to on page 3. What's the reason that the data collected, created, maintained is protected non-public data?
To respond to that.
Mr. Chair, I could begin to respond to that, and there might be a couple of other people here. I think we still would like to testify if there's time.
Could you identify yourself?
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Susan Hugard. I'm the Director of the Higher Education Services Office. Mr. Chair and Representative Opatz, in putting this bill together, I think there was some concern expressed, there was some concern about data that might be Mayo Clinic data, or there might be some data that's proprietary, that's IBM data, that might they might not want to have necessarily shared with the public. And so I think part of this was an attempt to respond to some of their concerns, and perhaps they can speak to that more appropriately than I can. We had this question presented to us before, and I think that we're, of course, willing to talk with this. I think with you about this. The attempt is not to keep the public out. We do want to have an open process, but at the same time, we want to be respectful of some of the information that some of these employers have that they might not be able, even actually able to share. So if there's a way to perhaps draft language that would protect some of that information, but still allow for an open process, we'd be very amenable to that.
Representative Lopez. Mr. Chair, if we're
going to
hold this over, this is one of those language items that cause interest by other committees, and you might want to make sure you perhaps run it by. And I'm not sure what this year that would be on data privacy, but I do like just making sure you're covered.
Thank you.
Okay, I understand civil law has already heard testimony on this bill.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't heard testimony. Okay, they've indicated they don't need to see it. That's what it is. Okay. Any other testifiers that would like to come forward at this time?
Mr. Chair, I thought there were other folks who wanted to
take it. Okay. We're almost prepared to move on. Representative Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For a clarification, I wonder if Representative Bishop would be willing to indicate if by fully funding the University of Minsky's request, he included in that the enrollment adjustments that are in current state law.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is a surprise. I think none of my colleagues from Rochester expected me to be here either. I come up to St. Paul once a month for a haircut, and that was my experience. My wife told me to go to St. Paul today.
Were there any troopers on the road today?
I told them, Mr. Chairman, I told them I was coming, and I think they laid off.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Latz, fully
is an adverb. A judgmental question. My statement that Representative Pulaski accurately stated did not include what Minsky or what the University of Minnesota asked for in any specific number. As a former legislator, fully becomes
a judgment question every 2 years for fully funding. It often does not meet what the source expects as full. It becomes something that works, something that balances with other funding. Fully funding the University of Minnesota is always, particularly in either the bonding bill or the appropriation bills, always has to take a look over your shoulder as you're doing it at what Minsky is getting for fully. So while I appreciate the specific question that you've asked, in my own opinion, the item that's asked for by Rochester has sufficient justification as an investment to be over and above what you judge to be fully funding the University of Minnesota, not what the University of Minnesota or Minsky thinks is full. It will change from biennium to biennium what they need. The University of Minnesota, I tried with President Udoff when I was chair of Ways and Means to get disclosure of what endowment money they had and what other sources of funds the University of Minnesota had, and I was never able to find out, even though they were asking the state for the money that they needed. They wouldn't tell us the assets that they had because they thought it was constitutionally protected. So that's a little perspective that you can have, Representative Latz, on what it means to be full. I sincerely believe, however, that the University of Minnesota is the primary engine as a research university and needs to have more money than it has been getting and to be full and to do the job that they want to do is in competition with the University of Minnesota or University of Wisconsin or Berkeley. And I was reading just recently how they want to climb. I support President Brunick's truly wise choice for a wise man. We need to keep the prime university in Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, fully funded. It's up to your job to balance it off. And all of you here to do so. You shouldn't do it by just nickeling and saying, let's not give $3 million to Rochester to expand, because Rochester is a growth area and it hasn't been able to be growing sufficiently. There are dynamic items in the Rochester community that need better education, and it's an investment that this committee should recommend. It doesn't mean that you could have to take a dime away from the University of Minnesota or from Minsky. They're both high quality and they need better funding than you're giving them.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you, and Mr. Bishop, Representative Latz.
Representative Bishop, thank you for your words, and I hope that your words are heard outside of this committee room as well.
Okay, unless I'm mistaken, I think we're ready to actually just officially lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So there's no dramatic ending to this. It's just we do thank you all for coming and for your participation and for testimony.
Let's just hold this one down, Johnny.
Representative Narna, I assume that you want to move this bill for possible inclusion.
That is correct. Mr. Chair, House File 1441. Now, this may involve some discussion, hopefully. House File 1441 specifically deals with the base adjustments for the university and for MidSCU. Both MidSCU and the university get part of their biennial appropriation based on projections of the number of students that they have enrolled. This biennium, the enrollment number was off by a rather large number, as you know. It caused the state to be $130 million short from MidSCU's base and $75 million short for the University of Minnesota's base. Traditionally, that difference has been less dramatic in past years. The state needs to know what it's going to be paying out over a two-year period as we do our budget so we can get the most out of our budget process. We've heard a lot during this session about holding MidSCU's feet to the fire over the state grant projections. It's only right that we also hold the system's feet to the fire regarding potential enrollment. By the time the enrollment adjustment numbers come out, if the state owes the system, some of the students have already graduated. It doesn't make a lot of sense to pay for students who are no longer students. By the same token, if we overpay the system, that money cancels back to the general fund, and it's lost from higher education. I would encourage the university and MidSCU to look at ways to reinvest that money in their students. HESA wants to establish a committee to look at this issue, but I maintain that the issues of appropriations are the prominent job of this committee. We can't keep passing our work on to outside committees, so we need to decide what is a valid reason to keep this process, or if it's no longer needed or outdated, and what to do next. K-12, as you all know, has a per-pupil formula. Things are a little different in K-12. The school there, particularly an inner-city school, may not know how many kids it has in its class until the first week or so of school. Colleges, however, have more advanced warning. The four-year colleges will know 9 months before classes start, in the two years they can look at local high school numbers and figure out their possible enrollment. It's a far different system than K-12. So, I'm only bringing up questions, I guess. I'm short on the answers. And hopefully we can discuss this and bring it up for discussion. We have, I think, MidSCU and the university both here and HESO. And so, you can start firing away if you would like to. And I hope I have helped you to answer. So,
Mr. Chair, this is not directed to Representative Dornis. We've already taken testimony on this, so I am interested in the two systems. I posed the question when the governor's supplemental budget came out, and President Brunix was clear he'd rather have his biennial request than the enrollment adjustment, that they would handle that internally. However, this has been a major part of the MidSCU system's initial budget request, and then subsequently it has also been their number one part of the budget request. So I am interested in MidSCU's opinion of this bill. So there we go.
For the record, my name is Judy Borgen. I'm Associate Vice Chancellor for Budget with MidSCU. And I just want to have a page. We have, in terms, Mr. Chair and Representative Blowski, yes, MidSCU has been very interested in enrollment adjustment, certainly in this biennium due to the size of it. It is not necessarily a misestimate of enrollment. It is really just a decision on our part to not ask for enrollment growth money for 05 and or 04 and 05 last biennium, but to wait until our enrollments got actually closer to actual rather than going on an estimate. So that it is a kind of combination of that. what we are saying here in our letter that Vice Chancellor King submitted to both Chair Norness and Chair Pappas in the Senate is that we welcome the review of the enrollment adjustment proposal that is in the governor's budget that I believe also the chair is going to be hearing in this committee on Wednesday. Suggest that there be put together a task force again to look at the enrollment funding formula, but that until that task force meets and comes back to this committee and to the Senate with a suggestion of what might replace it, we would like to have this language remain in statute. It certainly is something that in the next session you can affect and have that in place for the next budget request so that we can, in fact, if it is time, and I think we think after 10 years it certainly is time to look at the enrollment adjustment formula. It may not be what the state is having issues in terms of funding it, and so maybe it is time that it be replaced, but we'd like to do it through a committee process and have some discussion of it.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Borg, this eliminates the formula.
Yes, it does.
It's not a study. As Representative Norton said, it eliminates it. Now, by the budget you proposed to us, that was approximately how much?
In the current budget, our request is $130 million that is a result of this formula being applied to our current enrollment.
And, Mr. Chair, Ms. Borgen, if I spin the Minspeed tuition wheel, which I have in my folder, but I won't get out, but you can probably spin it in your head. You spin the wheel, what's that translate into a tuition increase?
I think if we were not to be funded for this, Mr. Chair and Representative Pawlowski, it would be somewhere in an 8.5%, I believe, tuition increase.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Borgen, let's assume this passes. You're no longer enrollment-driven. What will Minspeed do in its budget process if you're not going to be enrollment-driven? Right now, the Minsky institutions are increasing enrollment, and that apparently hasn't stopped. You have given us a projection where we would see a decline in enrollment in the foreseeable future. So we're going to have a continual increase in enrollment. You predicated your budget on it for over a decade, at least 8.5% increase in tuition. So this passes. What do you do? Just jack up tuition? I'll give you a hint.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, I assume that this bill would take effect for the next biennium. So I'm assuming that at this point, unless I'm not sure, and maybe the office can clarify that, but I'm assuming this would be effective for the next biennium, so that we would still have the request that is part of our base adjustment would still be before this body, and you would act on this if you were able to or not. In the future, if our enrollments continue to increase, we're not quite sure how funding would be. I'm assuming that the system would certainly come forward with a request for it in some manner. There wouldn't be a statutory formula, and we would be at the pleasure of the governor and the legislature in terms of whether we would be able to get additional funding, but it would not be automatic as K-12 and other formulas are, and this one is, at least we hope it is, in statute.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Borgen, you have some institutions in the Minsky system that aren't enrollment-driven now, that have actually capped enrollment, and have told you in advance what that cap will be. Could you tell me that those institutions, I'm very familiar with one, would other institutions then decide to go on a more conservative approach to enrollment and say, we're not going to take everyone who applies, we'll put a cap on enrollment, and we'll begin a process of limiting enrollment as a result of this passing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, that certainly could be one of the results of something like this, knowing that you would not be getting any money from the state automatically, at least for an adjustment in increase in enrollment. You might decide that because of the funds not being available, you might want to reduce that, or as I think you mentioned earlier, tuition would have to make up the difference if you, in fact, were going to continue to serve the enrollment but not be able to do it with state appropriation following.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Ms. Borgen, one more question. That would be a rather dramatic change in the Minsky institutions. It was a dramatic change for those institutions that adopted the caps and said, we're going to actually limit enrollment. And I don't know if I really want you to answer a question yet, but I think if this is going to be studied for a year, Minsky should take a very hard look at what happens when you move from enrollment-driven to what in effect would be caps, because I would assume that the minute this goes off the books, those institutions are going to have to make some very hard choices about the number of students that they can take, because the state funding will not follow the suit. Or, I think 8.5% is going to be a very conservative number for your tuition increases. I don't need an answer from you, but that's an observation.
Ms. Borgen, I just want to follow up on this comment because unless Minsky were to change its allocation formula, which is substantially driven by enrollments, it seems to me that institutions would still have a fair amount of incentive to pay attention to enrollments, because even though the pie that comes to Minsky wouldn't be affected by enrollments, and frankly, they really haven't done completely anyway. It seems to me that unless the system changes that formula, there still would be some of those driving factors. Do I have that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think that is correct. But I think that we would look internally at our formula also with a change in the state statute, because some of the things that we try to do within the formula try to at least recognize what the state is doing in terms of funding for us.
Representative Ergo has a
question. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Borgen, the state grant program is short on money, the prorate funds. When Minsky and University are short due to the same circumstances, increasing enrollments, you return to the state for more funds. Please explain to me what the difference is with that. Or why is there a difference?
Ms. Borden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, again, it is part of the formula that is in law that allows us to return to the state. I think as we have noted in the past, we have not really been able to get a lot of money when we have returned because of just the economic condition of the state has not been such that we have been able to receive the money that we would under the formula be entitled to. I guess in that respect, we end up prorating to our institutions. We have only the money to allocate that we are given from the legislature, and we turn to tuition and reductions to be able to balance our budget.
Any other area? Representative Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one correction. Some may say it was the economic condition of the state, but ultimately it's the fiscal constraints, however they are determined at the state budgetary level, not necessarily the economic condition of the state, that affects what allocations are made to Minsky. But I had two questions. One, my understanding, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Borgen, is that in the past, when overpayments were made to Minsky, when enrollment did not meet anticipation, was lower than anticipated, it's my understanding that as part of the enrollment adjustment, then Minsky would actually return money to the state. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Latz, that is correct. We have, for three bienniums, I believe, returned money because we misestimated our enrollment. And that's one of the reasons that we changed in this last biennium to not asking for money on projected enrollments, but getting closer to actual enrollments before we asked for adjustment in the funding, just so that we didn't end up in the situation where we were having to pay money back. And it just happened that we've had such huge increases in our enrollment in the last biennium that it ends up that we have a fairly large IOU.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Borden, and if I understand you correctly, when you say that you try to wait until you get closer to actual enrollment, that rather than trying to make a real serious two-year projection of enrollment, is that you basically said, here's where we are now, and we'll ask for that now, and we'll just assume for purposes of budgeting that our enrollment's going to remain essentially flat for the next 2 years. And then assuming also that if your enrollment goes up, 2 years down the road, you're going to get your enrollment adjustment to backfill the fiscal condition of SKU. Is that my understanding of what you're saying?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Glass, that is correct. That is what our intent is. And, you know, as we don't know what's going to happen in 06 and 07, we've not asked for any money for that.
Okay. And then my other question has to do, perhaps it's just as specific as a bill, maybe this is to Representative Nornes. But on page 1, line 12, where the language that is deleted not only includes a deletion for the enrollment adjustment, but also an adjustment, deletes the adjustment for inflation. Could you explain what the purpose of that is?
Good question. I think it just takes inflation out of the calculation like we've done. Yeah. Can you help us out?
How is that handled now? I
don't think it's factored in now, is it?
Mr. Chair, members, the formula currently allows for increases for inflation and later performance is also mentioned. As a practical matter, inflation has never been added to the formula in any biennium that this has been in operation.
Well, Representative Latz, I think that's the reason.
Any other questions?
If that's true, then it sounds like the calculation for the instructional services base has been contrary to statute, because it just looks to me like it's not discretionary within the statute. It says the base is the sum of. Am I misreading something here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Latz, you're correct that it's not discretionary. However, inflation is not defined. Mm-hmm. And again, as a practical matter, when the budget has been put together by the Finance Department and the Governor, inflation has effectively been defined as zero, which is not against the statute.
Well, then they could probably just as easily define enrollment as zero, too.
Mr. Chair, actually no, because earlier in the statute it does specify what enrollment is to be counted.
Oh, okay. is there anyone else in the audience to respond to this?
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, again, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, which is the State University faculty. We actually had some very divided feelings on this bill. First of all, we do believe that enrollment inflation and inflation are by far the two biggest cost drivers affecting higher education funding, and therefore they need to be recognized. As a matter of fact, I sat on the NSCU task force that put together the budget, and the one thing that all the constituencies put as their top priority was funding the enrollment growth that we had experienced. On the other hand, the current formula has been abrogated more than it's been honored ever since it's been on the books, and I will give credit to this bill. At least it's honest, and it ends the pretense that we even have a higher education formula in this state. In truth, it's very seldom been followed. First of all, shortly after they adopted the formula, we quit following the portion of the formula that says the state shall fund 67% of the cost, and by implication the students fund the other 33%. In reality, it's 50-50. We're not following that part of the statute. Then we began ignoring inflation. I actually think that there was one biennium where they honored inflation, but we don't honor the inflation. We just magically, I mean, I've raised this issue with the Department of Finance and years back, and they said, oh, we just assumed it was zero. And end of discussion. And then in recent decades, we just started pretending that enrollment didn't exist either. And it's quite easy to do. I passed out a handout that has a spreadsheet on one side and the governor's budget on the other, and you can see how it happens. I mean, they follow the law. The November forecast, they do the technical adjustment, and they say Minsky has $130.8 million coming for enrollment growth, but then two lines down, they just back it back out again. So, you know, we just don't have a formula to speak of. In statute, I distributed on the other side of this thing, I distributed a spreadsheet, which I think does a great job. I should, first of all, give credit. It was done by a fellow by the name of Pat Opatz over at Minsky. It was part of a chart that he had done. But I think it shows it just so wonderfully the interrelationship between inflation and enrollment and appropriation and tuition, because they're all interrelated. If you look at this spreadsheet and the first two columns, you look in 1999, Minsky's appropriation, this is their raw appropriation, not adjusted for inflation or anything, this is how many dollars you gave Minsky, was $549 million. This year is $546 million. It's about $3.5 million less in dollars. Now, if you go over to the fifth column, you see in 1999, Minsky had 106,000 FYE students. This year we got 136,000 FYE students. 30,000 more students and $3.5 million less state appropriations. And so, you know, it's obvious what happens, and you see that in the sixth column over, state appropriations just get diluted over more students. The appropriation per student drops from $5,148 down to $4,002 per student. Now, it gets worse, because we also have had 15% inflation over those last 6 years, and that hasn't been recognized. And so when you take into account the purchasing power, you see that the erosion has been even further over those years. Now, all of this has real-world effects. I mean, these aren't just numbers on paper. They have real-world effects. And the biggest effect that it's had, of course, has been on student tuition. If you look at tuition revenue, back in 1999, they were collecting, my eyesight's getting kind of bad here, but $230-some million dollars worth of tuition revenue. This year it's up to $517 million worth of tuition revenue. What happened? We just passed the cost of enrollment growth and inflation onto the students in terms of higher tuition. And of course, students are going deeper in debt. But in addition to that, we've also seen quality slip. If you look at the final column on this chart, even with the extra tuition revenue, when you add tuition and appropriations together, we've seen about a 600 per pupil decline in funding. And what that means is, effects on quality. We pretended that the price of utilities, the price of fuel, the price of keeping competitive salaries just doesn't exist. And as a result, those things have fallen behind. We've had higher class size. We've had faculty at our lobby day, for instance, explaining that their introductory class sizes jump from 100 to 200. Well, the instructor can't keep up correcting that many papers over a weekend, so they give less grading assignments to the student. It's had a dramatic effect on our competitiveness for salaries. And this is a quality issue. I can think of a few things that have greater impact on the quality of higher education than the instructor in front of the class. And we're now, I staff a Minsky IFO task force on salary competitiveness. We're below average on every single rank in terms of salary at Minsky right now. And those of you who have ever taken an economics course know that when you're below average, you're hiring from an applicant pool that's been 50% picked over by better paying institutions. I don't think we want to be there. We had 46 searches in Minuscule this year that totally failed. They could not get adequate applicants for it, so they just simply canceled the search rather than lock in on somebody that they just felt wasn't a decent quality. So, I guess I'd reiterate that enrollment and inflation are important in any funding formula. I've been around here since 1973. Every formula that we've ever had has included enrollment and in it. It only makes sense that an institution with 15,000 students like St. Cloud would get more funding than an institution with 3,000 like Southwest, or that if you have 106,000 students that you won't get as much money as if you had 106,000 students. So, to conclude, we think that the current formula is flawed, mainly because it's been ignored, but we think that we should start from scratch and redesign our formula. But until we do that, until we have something to replace the existing formula, we should recognize the enrollment that has occurred. That enrollment, by the way, is still there. The 72 million of it, these aren't students that have gone in permanently, and we don't have them anymore. Either they or their replacements are still there. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and
thank you. We're losing numbers, I think, the Ways and Means here. Mr. Insinuator, did you have some? No, your name is on the list, so I didn't want to ignore you, but you're fine. Okay. That would be a no. Well, with that, Representative Nornes, this bill will be covered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, okay. And are we prepared to adjourn?
We are prepared.
The committee is adjourned.